Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of Employment Matters, brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm your host, Tara Stingley, a partner with Klein Williams in Omaha, Nebraska. Along with bringing you updates and critical events happening around the world, we're also fortunate to have the chance to dial in our local ELA lawyers. These good folks practice on the ground in jurisdictions around the globe, working daily to help their clients move through these difficult times. On the program, we span the globe with updates on critical issues from ELA members in each region. Today, we're chatting with some of our members in West Virginia. So joining us today on the program are Susan Deniker, a member of Steptoe & Johnson, and Peter Lake, a professor at Stetson Law School and counsel at Steptoe & Johnson. Today, Susan and Peter are going to share with us a brief update on the impact of the Biden administration and Democratic Congress on higher education. Susan and Peter, welcome to the program. How are you both today?
Thanks, Tara. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Glad to have you. So, Susan, let's start with you. The new year brings obviously a new Democratic president and a Democratic Congress. What will be on the legislative agenda for the Biden administration as it relates to higher education?
Well, Tara, let me start by saying what a pleasure it is to be with my colleague, Peter Lake, who's truly an expert in higher education law. So as much as I'm excited to have some things to talk about today, I'm really excited to hear what Peter's input will be on these subjects because he's got such a great insight on this. You know, we've got an interesting time. We've seen a transition in terms of our president and also a switch to a Democratic Congress with a Democratic president. And there are a lot of eyes on this administration and the new Congress about what those changes mean, especially in the field of higher education. And of course, this administration comes in the midst of a pandemic that has, you know, really changed the face of our nation, and higher ed has not been an exception to the impact that the pandemic has had. So kind of looking beyond the initial pandemic issues, which we're dealing with just today in the news, many of our colleagues would have seen that the GOP stimulus proposal doesn't have any money in it for higher ed, which is a concern. But beyond those things, you know, we're looking down the road at what we think might happen. And of course, Title IX is on everybody's minds as it relates to potential changes. The Trump administration, as you know, promulgated new regs that were effective last August. And there was a big scurry of institutions to be compliant with that when it went into effect. And now everybody's looking around saying, okay, we did that. And now what? And I think that there's a really good possibility that we'll see changes there. Certainly, the Biden administration during the campaign signaled dislike for portions of the Title IX regulations, including the cross-examination provisions that were a concern voiced by many folks. And we saw, of course, in Biden's initial transition period, an executive order which extended the Title IX protections to folks based upon sexual orientation and sexual identity. So he's already signaled, right, a desire to make some changes there that he can do through executive order. Now the question is he going to go out and seek some changes as it relates to those regulations? One thing that Peter and I have talked about is the appointment of Suzanne Goldberg as acting head of OCR. So Peter, talk to us a little about what you think that signals, that he made that decision to put Suzanne Goldberg in an acting role instead of a permanent position.
Yeah, thanks, Susan and Tara. It is great to be here today. I appreciate being here and particularly being on with one of the nation's leading labor and employment lawyers, Susan Deniker. It's a real honor to be here with you all. Susan Goldberg represents someone with a lot of operational experience, battlefield experience in Title IX. The acting role probably signals that there's some cleanup and transition work to do that's so complicated that we need someone with her skill set to try to figure out. And, you know, I want to back up a little bit on the Biden administration agenda in just a minute, but I do think that the connection between Title IX and Title VII is a mess right now. The state of the regulations and how the Biden administration intends to interpret those or reinterpret them, perhaps reimagine them, could lead to a variety of different legal techniques that I have a feeling we'll be seeing rolling out over the next couple of months from the Department of Ed, with Susan Goldberg, I think, playing a critical role in all of that. And you could see anything from a legislative package that might alter Title IX and Title VII to a notice and comment period, perhaps negotiated rulemaking. I know we'll see some guidance documents. And of course, one of the big ones is, as you remember, in the 2000 page tome that dropped last summer, mid-pandemic. I think many of you remember that in Title IX, at 2000 pages. Most of it was commentary. And one has to wonder whether or not this administration might decide, through Susan Goldberg, to, shall we say, offer a new director's version of Henry V. The play is rather short, but the director's notes are fairly long. So I am truly curious, and I think education lawyers in particular need to pay very close attention to this, because I am confident that they're not just thinking about students, they're thinking about employees and staff. And people recognize that students are sometimes employees, and et cetera, right? So there's a cross-fertilization there of roles on campus. And I am certain, I mean, to a 90th percentile, that the new acting director, Goldberg, will be deeply aware of the challenges of trying to manage multiple systems with different metrics that don't really match up terribly well. And I know Susan spends a lot of time operationally with our clients trying to just pick through some of these basic things. One other thing, and I don't mean to be too long-winded about this, but there are a lot of resolution agreements out there that are just deeply needful of both the Department of Ed and the Department of Justice to reimagine what those consent agreements or other agreements mean in light of the changes in rules. And I'd say that Goldberg has the task of Hercules cleaning the Phrygian stables right now. This is one mess to try to make sense of. And again, I think employment lawyers need to really focus on that. You know, backing up to the Biden agenda just generally, the first thing I think we have to get used to is we aren't the top priority in America right now. We're a priority, and I think a deeply held priority for Biden and the First Lady, actually, in particular. But there are other things that are more pressing. You know, we live in a violent society that's politically divided. We have a pandemic. We have international allies to shore up. And the president's going to be a busy person. So we're probably going to see bits and pieces of a higher ed agenda as the top priority items get more managed and we can get to higher ed. But I see a couple of things. One is there's a lot of emphasis on career and success. So I think this administration is going to think about building careers and then successful careers. I think the administration is going to be very, very tuned into funding and debt relief. And it appears that they're very interested again in the for-profit sector. So that's something I think we're going to be watching. We seem to might perhaps be moving back a little to Obama's period on the for-profit industry. And this time, I think HBCUs, which really sort of had a tap-and-go experience in the Trump administration, are much more likely to see meaningful emphasis, because I think the other deeply held meme or value, you know, we talk career, success, social justice, and expect those to be major features of what's coming forward. And just, you know, a word to the wise on employment lawyers out there, the way we handle matters tactically and incrementally is going to be visible to this department. They're going to want to see that we're oriented around these critical ideas of career success and social justice. And I think you're going to see the management of both justice and ed is likely to be tuned in that direction. So please keep that in mind. I think your clients need to know this, that there's sort of a play on the field energy right now that will likely persist for at least 2 years. And then, of course, we'll see what happens at the midterms and beyond. But I think you've got 19 months of concentrated effort on these three dominating themes: social justice, career and success, and debt management.
So the pandemic has obviously impacted life in general, but especially the operations of colleges and universities since last spring. What do you foresee as the long-term changes as a consequence of the pandemic?
It's a great question, Tara. You know, in a little bit, we've all been in emergency mode. Right. I mean, last spring, this pandemic hit, institutions of higher education had to make really very, you know, quick changes about operations and how to move forward. And we've been in pandemic mode since then. But I think some of the changes that have come about are things we're going to continue to see. So we've seen an emphasis on the financial status of institutions of higher education because of the pandemic. But candidly, we had a lot of institutions under extreme financial pressures prior to the pandemic. In some ways, the government stimulus money, frankly, was a lifeline to some of these institutions because they were eligible for loans through the government programs that will likely be forgiven and other stimulus money. So that's created a little bit of a lifeline. We're looking to see what's going to happen now in terms of additional stimulus money. I think that there's a feeling that some of the lack of, or at least perceived lack of the Trump administration to support more funding for institutions of higher education may be a little softened in the Biden administration. But again, as Peter's pointed out, we've got, you know, pandemic first issues. So we're going to continue to see these financial issues be a problem for institutions, especially some of our smaller private institutions. You know, it's no secret that we've seen a decrease in enrollment as we have had a decrease in college age population. That trend will continue, especially in certain areas of the country like the Northeast. And so we're in a situation where colleges are really going to have to pivot on financial issues, certainly. This has also brought about a lot of discussion about restructuring of employment of academic professionals. So the tenure process, unless you've got a job for forever, you can't get rid of people, has made it really very challenging for institutions to be able to respond to the financial environment. The pandemic really, again, shed a light on that because as institutions were worried about perhaps having to downsize to, you know, be able to meet their budget expectations, it's put more focus on that. I think that that change was coming before. It's coming harder and faster now post-pandemic, and it's something that no longer can be ignored. Now, if there's one good thing about the pandemic, institutions of higher education are traditionally thought to be slow movers, right? They tend to adapt slower than the regular business world. That's been its reputation. And frankly, they've lived up to that reputation in the past. But candidly, what we saw from institutions in March of 2020 showed that, you know what, they can be agile when they need to be. And when we've got to make changes and make it quickly, we can do it. And we've seen institutions, I think, realize that they're more adaptable than they thought that they were. You know, Peter has the benefit of seeing both worlds. I get to work with institutions of higher education every day and love doing that. But Peter has the dual role of working with me and our other colleagues at Steptoe & Johnson with higher education clients, but he's on the ground at Stetson working in that day in and day out. So Peter, I'm interested in your perspective on this.
Well, Susan, you know, I certainly am, in addition to being a practicing attorney, I'm also one of those people. I'm an employee, a tenured faculty member. And so I get to go to faculty meetings once a month, to say the least, and that gives you perspective. I also am in the classroom. And here's my thought on the pandemic, Tara. I think that it's a catalyst. It's doing to colleges what it's doing to Americans. If you have an underlying health issue, you're more at risk. And it's going to change just about everything that we're doing and have done. The workplace has changed. And the idea that your office is your home is, for so many people, is a, you know, really kind of a radical idea in higher ed, but now I think will become very common. And I suspect that institutions post-pandemic will take advantage of that opportunity for remote work and also remote learning. Hybridization is here to stay. I think the future college is hybridized both in the workforce and in the classroom. I think the idea of a central campus will begin to change because we now realize that we don't have to rely on central physical plant as much as we once did. And I think you're going to see some, shall we say, outreach or decentralization that's going to come. A couple of things that I think are really prominent with the pandemic is it's forced us to see where our real wealth is. And now we know that the wealth of a university does not lie in its endowment or its buildings or its cash reserves. It lies in the goodwill with the community, but most particularly in the efficacy that occurs among teachers, administrators, and students. This is where our real strength is. And schools with huge endowments have gone out of business. The ones that have strong support from student, faculty, staff, and alumni are the ones that are really thriving through all of this. This is a lesson I learned in the 1980s on Wall Street, watching businesses restructure in another era. And so for employment lawyers, I think there are some important takeaways here. Be careful cutting the things that actually make your business survive and thrive, because you can put yourself in a death spiral trying to save the plane from crashing. A lot of planes crash because the pilots push a button in panic, and then the plane crashes because of that, not because it was originally in trouble. And I would say be particularly cautious, and I see this out there, about reorienting longstanding promises of employment without expecting backlash for that. You know, we're watching Kansas, for example, right now. And Tara, you know, there we are. We're sort of, you know, not too far from where you are physically. I know that's not Kansas, but you know, you see it from a baseball pitch away. And the idea that you can end longstanding agreements short of exigency is going to be a tested issue in court. People are going to fight for their employment rights. And the other thing, and this is, I'm going to say this, I'm probably one of the first saying it and pushing it, is we must be very mindful of age discrimination litigation, because there's a tendency to go after older, more expensive faculty members, and I can guarantee you that's coming. So I believe the Biden administration and some courts will pick up on a social justice theme here, and let's not walk into major issues with age discrimination because we're not paying attention. And I really am concerned about it, particularly with an aging population that's going to be increasingly sensitive to a shift in balance of power from older Americans to younger Americans. Watch this become something on the front. So to restructure, to be a good employment lawyer in this context, I think means seeing the bigger picture and helping your institutions find a way to survive and thrive, but not cutting away at critical features of an institution that make it unsustainable, or worse yet, walking your institution into short-term solutions that lead to long-term equal opportunity litigation problems. And I think that's going to be our mission, is to try to walk that line and help our clients see it and use our experience to do that. Susan, do you agree with that?
You know, Peter, I think that those are really great points you make. And, you know, the other thing is I talked a little bit about, you know, there is change afoot and change is coming. And I do think that we're going to see some change in the next few years. I think in some ways, higher ed has to adapt a little bit. You know, a lot of ways, higher ed doesn't see itself as corporate America. But when you look at the size of institutions, the budgets, the number of employees, candidly, right, they're up there in major corporations, but haven't acted that way historically. I think that the financial pressures are going to push them to look more like that. But you're right. We can't just abandon the past. We can't just abandon principles like shared governance, which, right, are critical to the very essence of our institutions. And the other thing is we've got to be careful that we don't fall into the trap of a one-size-fits-all mindset. I mean, part of the brilliance of higher ed in this country is the diversity of it amongst our institutions and the environments. And even just in working with institutions on employment matters, been cautioning them just because you see in the Chronicle that institution A is doing XYZ doesn't mean that that model fits you for all kinds of reasons, partly because, frankly, everybody's handbooks and policies are different. And, you know, faculty handbooks are typically, you know, contractual documents along with appointments. And so these things become really complicated. They're not easy to untie. And as Peter mentions, you know, there are a lot of employment ramifications legally that go there. So these are not going to be things that we can change quickly or that are going to wholesale change. And we see some folks out there that are ready to meet the challenge, but the best way to be able to handle that is with a joint venture with community, including the faculty community. So all really great points.
Absolutely. So to switch gears a little bit, the Biden administration's policy positions on immigration issues, they're a bit different than the prior administration. In fact, they probably stand in stark contrast. On a practical level, what do you think that means for institutions of higher education?
Well, I'll take the lead on this and then I'll let Peter talk a little bit about it. But, you know, I think that there's a little bit of a sigh of relief in the higher ed community that there's going to be a, you know, an environment here politically that is a little bit more open on some of these immigration issues, because this, you know, while the nightly news is talking about the border wall, the practicalities on higher ed is that we saw a decrease in international students on our campus. We had harder times with folks on visas that were researching and teaching at our institutions. And so this has been a really challenging time for higher ed on these immigration issues. Certainly the Biden administration's platform during the election and in Biden's initial executive orders coming into office indicate that there's going to be a big difference here. So I think there's a sigh of relief that, you know, the DACA program has been continued. The Trump administration decided not to further pursue that. You know, the Supreme Court decision that came out was really a technicality that was going to be easily corrected. They didn't push that toward the end of the administration, but DACA was really hanging in the balance. The Biden administration coming in saves that program. You saw that Biden has extended that and has opened up, you know, travel and visas from Muslim countries where we didn't have that before. So I think that there is a hope that, you know, for institutions that we will see an increase in international students coming in. But I got to think that there's some fear out there in that community about coming into the United States when kind of the future is uncertain and we don't know what congressional action may look long term. I think too that as you watch the news in the last couple of years, other countries saw what the United States had seen, which was international students come in and frankly pay full rate for tuition and board. National students typically paid a discounted rate. And so those students were critical, frankly, to the bottom line of many institutions. The absence was keenly felt by many of our institutions across the country. And we'll see how that corrects. But, you know, other countries like Australia, frankly, have taken on a lot of that international student population and figured out what the United States realized a few years ago, which is that's kind of a key component, frankly, for the diversity of some of our institutions for many reasons. You know, also, too, on the employment front, we're looking at wanting to keep some of our scholars and researchers, what we do long term with visa requirements. You know, things like allowing folks that earn an American university PhD to have looser visa requirements, et cetera, may encourage some of these folks to stay in. And it's going to be interesting. What I don't think that we'll see a change in is kind of the skepticism and the concern about espionage issues at some of our research institutions and some of the issues we've seen along those lines. Those concerns, I think, will continue and will be more of a bipartisan issue. Peter, what do you think this means coming up here?
As we're talking at this moment, it's my understanding that President Biden has executive orders on his desk regarding immigration. So we couldn't be more on time right now when we're talking. And I think what it means is more to come. And I think you're absolutely right, Susan. I think we're going to reopen connections to students coming in studying abroad into the United States. I think the big challenge comes down to this. Can we convince foreign students that we're not going to be engaged in populism field position football? So that you come for a four-year degree, 2 years from now, Congress changes hands and federal policy starts to shift again, 4 years from now, perhaps more dramatically. I don't know if people trust us yet. And I think rebuilding that sense that if you come, you'll get to complete will be a major challenge, I think, for ever returning to the place that we were prior to the Trump administration. So I'll see that. And the other thing is, I'm not sure what some students are coming for. And I think some of the sectors now have constricted or will constrict in ways that it will be more difficult for foreign students to come and study. For example, the Alaska system has taken a major slash. And I think some foreign students will look at certain parts of the United States and think, I'm not sure that I'm as comfortable studying there today as I would have been 6 or 7 years ago, even if I'm given the opportunity to do that. And I do worry that, and I'm sure that foreign students worry about this as well, that if they make a presence in certain places and it's a, you know, kind of a blue circle and a red dot somewhere on the map, that they might become the targets of community issues that they would rather avoid. So, you know, we've got some significant repair work, I think, to do to convince people to come back. And again, as some state institutional systems are moving towards, you know, a perfectly legitimate, if they want to do it, focus on parochial education. In other words, you know, serving the citizens of that state, the message will be the doors are not as welcome to people who are coming from abroad. So we're going to have to see what's there and what's coming. And I think it's more than just signing executive orders. It's going to be trying to convince people to come back. And I could go on and on, but I'll I think those are the main points I should probably make.
So one final question. There's been some talk about the nation facing an edupocalypse, if I use that term correctly. Tell me what that means and what the higher ed community can do to successfully navigate that.
Yeah.
Let me jump in, Peter, because I just want to be clear that this is a Peter trademarked term. I don't know if you really trademarked it, but this is vintage Peter Lake. So the talk about it has started and evolved from our very own Peter Lake here.
Yeah. Edupocalypse is a term I've been using to try to describe the convergence of forces that are coming in on higher education simultaneously. the industry has a lot of distress. And earlier in our conversation, I had mentioned COVID as a catalyst. And I really do believe it's a catalyst. It has kickstarted issues that were there and then made them much more visible and more immediate. It's had a catalyzing effect. And I could talk about this for days, and I'm not going to do that, but it comes down to something this simple. Our customer supply has been challenged. There are fewer young people. We talked about immigration a minute ago and some of the challenges there. There are major financial issues in this country, and they were there even before COVID. The funding of higher education and who bears the cost has been a significant issue. I think more fundamentally, I noticed that red, blue, and purple people agree on one thing. Nobody watches all the TV networks simultaneously, but this is something that Americans actually agree on, is higher ed is a big problem. You know, if you talk to the Obama era people, you'd hear too much sexual violence on campus. If you talk to Trump, we ran kangaroo courts. And I just can't help but believe that there's probably going to be some negative narrative that's going to emerge during this period as well, because everybody's got a gripe and it's going to court. It's going to the regulators. It's going to Congress. And we're finding increasingly that we're getting sued. We're losing cases. We're more heavily regulated, and we're trying to cope with a society that just doesn't really trust higher education all that much anymore. And I think this is a really fundamental challenge that's focused in higher education. And one thing I want to be careful of, particularly with employment lawyers, is there's a tendency in a huge business down cycle to sort of look for the people to blame. And one of the focal points is our faculty and administrators. I mean, I've heard administrators referred to as deanlets. I've heard faculty referred to in all sorts of derogatory terms in the press. And you know, we are the chefs in the kitchen. We bring the food out and cook it for the people. And if you start attacking the core of the business, then that business doesn't have much of a chance to survive. Now, that's all dark and gloomy. Woo-hoo, nah-da, dark tones. But I want to say something is, in every challenge, there's opportunity. And the thing that we need to prepare for now is the roaring 20s, which are going to come. And they're going to roar, not quite like the first set of 20s, but they're going to roar. I can guarantee you that. And we may face very quickly a V curve where all of a sudden we go from wah, wah to wow, you know, explosion of social activity, people wanting to return to campus, spending their money very freely to come get more education. Are we ready for that? And, you know, this sort of ties a knot from earlier before. If we cut too many people and lose institutional memory and create negative relations between staff, students, and faculty, when the green fields come, there'll be nothing to plant. People are going to go to the places that are thriving. And underneath all of this, I think, means that we need to think preventatively and proventatively. How do we think forward? This is what COVID has forced us to do, think more long-term, and to think, how do we build a thriving community as opposed to how do we merely survive? And my challenge to education lawyers everywhere is, can you help your clients build a thriving community or just get through tomorrow? And it's going to be hard because I work with Susan Deniker, who just doesn't sleep. And we run this intense holistic practice at Steptoe, which is exceptionally demanding on the people in the practice group. But our focus is to try to keep focus on making sure our clients can really grab the brass ring when it's there and not stumble to the finish line right when the great opportunity presents itself. And I'm here to promise you it will. There will be brighter days ahead. We have a challenging time now, but it's what we do now that tells me what the yield from the fields will be down the road.
Well, I don't know about anybody else, but Peter has me super excited about the roaring 20s. And I think all of us have to acknowledge that a key component of success, and you know, you don't have to have spent very much time awake in history class to know that education is the key, right? The success of any society. It is the linchpin here. We can't ignore that. And I hope that as we get out of this pandemic world, and it can't happen soon enough for any of us, that we do hit into this roaring 20s that Peter's forecasting, because we're ready for it. And our higher ed clients are going to be at the core of it, because they're a critical part of how we move forward in this country.
Well, I think we're all looking forward to that forecast paying off sooner rather than later. Thank you both. This has been a fascinating discussion on the issues and the opportunities that are facing higher ed. Susan and Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us. Peter, always a pleasure to get to spend some time with you.
It's the best part of the day.
If you'd like to connect with Susan or Peter or any of our lawyers around the world, please search for them on the ELA website at ela.law. Just go to the big Find a Lawyer widget in the center of the page, where you can also sign up to receive invitations to our upcoming webinars, download white papers, get on-demand content from our online library, or access the ELA's exclusive Global Employer Handbook. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Tara Stingley. Thanks so much for listening.